Good morning, and welcome to Live Dharma Sunday for June 16th, 2013. It's Father's Day, so happy Father's Day, dads everywhere. I'm Wendy Shinyo-Halet, your host again for today, giving Reverend Coyle a well-deserved Father's Day off. A little later, I'll probably talk a bit about Father's Day and what I learned from my father, but now let's introduce Doug Cuyo-Slayton. Doug Cuyo is a Bright Dawn, whose Bright Dawn lineage name means Sky Sun, currently lives in Langley, Washington on Whidbey Island. He's moved there with his wife, Patty, from Southern California following his retirement as a public health physician and quarantine medical officer with the CDC. Cuyo went to medical school at 30 years old, then served as a medical officer in the U.S. Navy before joining the CDC. In addition to his education to be a medical doctor, he also holds an undergraduate degree in music history and plays guitar. He was inducted as a lay minister with Bright Dawn in 2011. So here is Doug Cuyo Slayton for today's Dharma Glimpse. Doug?
This Dharma Glimpse is something of a departure from my usual style, and that makes me a little nervous. My preferred approach is to come up with the hook, as they say in the songwriting business, and then the rest is elaboration and explanation. The glimpse I'm going to talk about today isn't like that. It deals with an aha experience rather than an intellectual realization, and as such makes me suspect its authenticity. By this, I mean that the way my mind works, if something isn't complicated or difficult, it probably isn't true. I like to tell the story about what a friend of mine said to me that went something like, Doug, if there were two doors and one said door to heaven and the other said door to lecture on heaven, you'd go to the lecture. Okay, enough already. Here's the glimpse. My wife Patty and I were sitting on our porch the other day enjoying a blissful sunny afternoon. Looking down, I saw a crow walking across the lawn below me. The sight dimly registered in my mind, but crows are common birds, and it was mainly its ungainly walk that got my attention. I may also have wondered idly about how much walking crows seem to do. As I was about to lose interest, the crow's tail, which was going back and forth as a result of its waddling gait, brushed the stem of a buttercup and caused it to sway back and forth. The bird continued on its way, and behind it the flower kept moving. Suddenly my perspective changed, and the creature was no longer the generic crow or the idea of a crow I carry around, but an individual bird making its way through the world, bumping into things. It was an immediate awareness that had no thought attached to it. This appreciation vanished as quickly as it arose, but just for an instant I stopped thinking and judging and experienced the suchness of a commonplace event. Now I'm at the point in the Dharma Glimpse where I would typically start elaborating on my theme and draw parallels and analogies. But I can't really analyze this experience. In fact, the more I talk about it, the further away I get from it. But I think there is a teaching here about intuition and other ways of knowing. Patty, Cuyo, and I have been meditating diligently, but my dedication to the practice can be derailed when things aren't going well. At times like these, I lose faith. And as William James said in The Varieties of Religious Experience, my mental field narrows almost to a point. Instead of beginner's mind, I have expert's mind, which sees few possibilities. But I don't have to be stuck there. And when my distracted mind isn't in charge, an effortless sense of awareness is revealed. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. I'm laughing about the story you told about your friend's description of you as being presented with two doors, one to heaven and one to the lecture on heaven. I totally can identify with that, and I think many of us can. And your reference to beginner's mind versus expert's mind, it reminds me and probably others out there who know the story of the Zen koan story about a university professor who goes to a famous Zen master seeking Zen teachings from this renowned master. And the master welcomes the student. You know, he sits down and the master asks if he would like a cup of tea. And the student accepts and the master begins to pour tea into the student's cup. But he keeps pouring and pouring and pouring. And the tea goes to the brim of the cup. Then it flows over and the master continues to pour. Finally, the professor is wondering if this guy's crazy. And he finally can't restrain himself. And he says, "Why are you still pouring the tea? The cup is overflowing." Of course, the master replies, "Like this cup, you are full of your own opinions and speculations. How can I show you then unless you first empty your cup?" You know, I think many of us, I'll speak for myself, but I think many of us can identify with this, is when we came to study the Dharma, study Buddhism, we came as book Buddhists, and I think stayed book Buddhists for way too long, like the professor. We keep reading, acquiring more knowledge of different schools of Buddhism, different lineages, studying sutra commentaries, following different lamas or masters around, collecting empowerments and dharma names. And I think probably this could be said for not just for Buddhists, but for spiritual practitioners of all faiths and belief systems, searching for and accumulating new and different and rare books and malas and rosaries and pendants and necklaces and statues and altars and candles and incense and special herbs, oils, and sitting cushions. And some of us might even try to sit and meditate once in a while. But we're still filling our cups, crowding our brains with information. And I think when we do that, we miss the Dharma that's right under our noses, as the crow waddles past the buttercup. I remember thinking in the first year of the Bright Dawn Ministry training program, we're taught right away, like within the first week of our training, to present Dharma glimpses. Now, for many of us, I know for me, it was a bit intimidating. Even though I had given Dharma talks before, there was something about being scheduled to do a Dharma glimpse. I'd feel anxious the week before in a search to find just that perfect something appropriate for subject for a Dharma glimpse. But see, what Reverend Coyle was teaching us, he was teaching us that this isn't necessarily studying and regurgitating what we already know, but it's a glimpse of the Dharma in our everyday lives. Not to search, but really just to keep our eyes open. Dharma is teaching every minute, everywhere. But I think most of us are too busy reading or looking for it to really see it. It's like those Where's Waldo books, or for all of us on Facebook, it's those posts that ask you whether you see two faces or a vase. Now, when you're looking at a Waldo book, you're presented with sort of this cartoonish, you know, colorful wonderland little scene of trees and, you know, clouds and rocks and animals and grasses and flowers and you know, I think most of us just look and see that scene. We look at it as it is to present it ourselves. But Waldo's hiding right in plain sight, although he may be the bark of the tree. And when you look at those Facebook posts, when they say whether it's, you know, two faces or a vase. Now, when I see two faces, once I see two faces, I cannot see that vase. And if you walk into that vase, you cannot see two faces. Things are the way they are to us, based on what we're looking for and how open we are to seeing what's there. You know, actually, Doug Cleo's experience or his talk about the crow reminds me of an actual crow experience I had. I was sitting on the porch working on my laptop, wasn't paying attention to what was going on in the yard around me in this beautiful porch. I was looking at the laptop. And then something in my peripheral vision changed. Some movement caught my eye. Maybe the sunbeam was interrupted by a shadow or it was a cloud. But I quickly glanced and immediately went into sort of an alarm mode, because my brain interpreted what were actually four or five crows walking around in the yard in a clump. My brain saw them as two black dogs running towards me. And so for a few seconds, those crows were black dogs running towards me. That was my experience. It was real, as the actual crows were real when I finally focused and saw that they were crows. Now, so, you know, it's like dreams. Sometimes you meet people in your dreams that when you wake up, you know they're a friend of yours. And you say, oh, Julie was in my dream. But the person in the dream didn't at all look like your friend Julie, but somehow your mind had interpreted that in the dream and it stuck with you, and therefore it was true. Dreams, the stuff in our world is pretty much up for interpretation, even by our own selves, let alone interpretation of other people's vision of the world. And each individual's interpretation is kind of, it's colored by a complex web of causes and conditions. In Buddhism, we know as, you know, interdependency, that we are not really a discrete, fixed self. And these causes and conditions, we can't know about their causes and conditions, because we don't really even know our causes and conditions. What really attributes to the way we see everything every day? As the Buddhism boot camp author, Timber Hawkeye, says, the opposite of what you know is also true. And that's something to reflect on. I love that saying, because it's another way of saying, but in a more everyday walking around world kind of way, things are not as they seem, nor are they otherwise. Which is an email signature line I use from the Lankavatara Sutra. So if you don't really see a crow walking, then you are trapped in a linear, conceptual, dual perspective of the world, the either-or perspective. But that blocks you from the non-dual perspective of, say, mystics, believers in a spiritual or transcendent realm, artists, poets, writers, engineers, inventors, scientists, and even mathematicians. The actual door to heaven is there, but you're only attending the lecture on how to get there. I think I've read or saw or it was written, I'm not an expert on Michelangelo, but I think he stared a block of marble for 4 months before he created and sculpted from that marble the Statue of David. Now, you have to ask yourself, for those 4 months of he staring at that block of marble, is he conceiving what that marble is? Is he making it? Was it, there's no label on it. It's sort of divining what it is. And where does vision come from? You know, in writing class, we are cautioned to show, not to tell. That means going beyond labels and concepts and just being with an experience or a setting, being with the marble. Let the marble tell you what it is. The world would be pretty dull. Nothing new would have been invented. There would be no art, no novels or stories if we stuck to what we already know, stuck to what we already have a name for or learned in a book. You know, I've seen insects. This always amazes me. This is my aha moment. It seems like almost every day I run into an insect, I have no idea what it is. I've never seen it before. I mean, and I'm 60 years old, so I don't know its name, don't know what it is. But do I deny that it exists because I don't have a name for it or a label for it or haven't read about it in a book or seen its picture on the internet? Now, I don't. You're probably wondering how I'm going to turn this into Father's Day. Like, because I said I would talk about my father. And all of this actually totally brings me back to remembering my father, who passed away in 2006. My father was a great teacher to me, but probably not in the way you expect me to tell you about right now on a Father's Day talk. Yes, I loved and still love my dad. He was a great father who loved and respected his four kids, encouraged us in our dreams, wanted the best for us, worked hard to give us whatever we wanted, and he did, and never said no to us when we asked for anything. Yet, that's not the biggest lesson I learned from my father. The biggest lesson I learned from my dad was things are not as they seem, nor are they otherwise. My dad taught me the Lankavatara Sutra through his struggles with bipolar mental illness. My dad's bipolar condition was, he kind of mostly manifested as mania. Some bipolars go back and forth a lot between depression and mania. Not that he didn't go to the depression area, but generally he was lived in that manic realm. So pretty much he was present all the time. He was a very big presence, and he was the biggest energy in any room he was in. In an essay tribute that I wrote for my dad's obituary, I titled it Beautiful Mind, Big Ideas. You know, I sort of took literary license and borrowed the title from Sylvia Nasser's biography of the mathematical genius and Nobel laureate John Nash. Now, John Nash was a schizophrenic, and so he saw the world quite differently, too. And if any of you have read the book or seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't read the book or seen the movie, do so. It's a fascinating story. So my dad, much like John Nash, saw the world very differently through the perspective of his bipolar disease. A day before my dad's death, his grandson Dan said, "I think he is why I have so many big ideas." Now, these words describe my dad perfectly. He lived in the realm of big ideas. And those of us who received one of his frequent phone calls or visits heard plenty of those ideas up until the very last days of his life. My dad was brilliant, but he was also different. Yet many or most would really have labeled him maybe crazy or insane, not brilliant. And after talking to him during unmedicated periods, mostly that's how people labeled him. Yet as the years went by, I learned that no matter how crazy it seemed to me to rake snow, or how crazy it seemed that he continued to claim for years and years that there were electrical waves running through his apartment coming from some special device that the scientist son of his neighbor designed and installed just to torture him. Now, it didn't make it not true to him just because I couldn't experience it. If I looked at that block of marble that Michelangelo looked at, I would see a block of marble. So I learned to nod in agreement and even ask questions about the wedding being planned. Oh, the one he, the 87-year-old man in their nursing home, and the 30-year-old nursing assistant was going to have. They were going to get married. I didn't question him. I didn't say no. I just listened to his story. Yet my dad, at the same time, was tender-hearted and brilliant. And that was also true. Once we label something as crazy, or label it as a crow or black dogs, we stop the possibility for it to be anything else, because we immediately begin responding to that person or thing or that situation just and only as we labeled it. You know, in the larger Pure Land Sutra, actually in all the Pure Land Sutras of the trilogy of the Pure Land Sutras, there's these long, long descriptions of what the Pure Land is like. And in our linear minds, it sounds absolutely crazy. I'll read a bit just so you see what I'm saying if you're not familiar with the Pure Land Sutra. This is the Buddha talking to one of his attendants, Ananda. The devas and humans in the land of Amitayas are each provided with robes, fruit and drink, flowers, perfume, ornaments, silken canopies, banners, and are surrounded by exquisite sounds. In addition, there's a beautiful jeweled fabric covering the ground where all the devas and humans walk. In that Buddha land, there are innumerable jeweled nets, all adorned with skins of gold thread, pearls, and 100,000 kinds of rare and marvelous treasure. All around the nets hang jeweled bells of the utmost beauty, which shine brilliantly. When a natural breeze of virtue arises and gently blows, it is not neither cold nor hot, and refreshing and soft to the senses. It moves neither too slowly nor too quickly. When the breeze wafts over the nets and the various jeweled trees, countless excellent sounds of the Dharma are heard, and 10,000 kinds of delicate fragrances of virtue are diffused. If one smells those fragrances, one's impurities and passions spontaneously cease to arise. If touched by the breeze itself, one enjoys the same pleasure as a monk who entered the samadhi of extinction. Again, flowers are scattered throughout the Buddha land. They spontaneously divide into different colors, not mixed together. They are soft and pleasant to the touch. And on and on and on and on. This description goes page after page after page. Now, this is not written for our linear minds. This is written so that you will go out of your linear mind, so to speak. Become a little crazy with what might be possible. Become a little crazy, maybe in your imagination or your intuition. Maybe if we trained ourselves to listen to what is not rather than what is, all possibilities would open up for us. You know, where can we glimpse the Dharma? Back to our Dharma glimpses that we had to create in our training, where can we glimpse the Dharma? Where do we find the Buddha and the Dharma? Where do we find God? We could find the Dharma in a book, or the Buddha in a temple, or God in a church. But it's much more possible that we will find what we're looking for right where we are. In our own minds, hearts, yards, and neighborhoods, we can see Buddha or God in the faces of our family, dogs, cats, friends, neighbors, and coworkers. But if your head is full of concepts of what the Dharma is, who Buddha is, who God is, or what is the absolute transcendent divine, or the boundless infinite light of great compassion of Amida Buddha, then remember, stop yourself and say, not this, not this. It is not this, nor is it. It is only when you release your life, the people in it, and the world around you from the shackles of what has been labeled, will you see the Dharma. If I could see everything in my world and every person in my world from that space for even 10 minutes a day, my cup would be empty. And everything around me, all the trees, sing the Dharma. That's all I have for today. Happy Father's Day. And as Reverend Coyle says, have a beautiful day. It's all around you.